Hello, welcome to the Longform Podcast. I am Evan Ratliff from The Atavist. I am joined by my co-hosts, Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer from longform.org.
Hey guys.
Hey there.
Quick break from the constant hammering in our studio.
Got a little construction going on.
It's a nice feature of any recording studio, it's a constant hammering.
Well, it's actually considered good luck to have a carpentry shop above your studio. Evan, who'd you talk to this week?
This week I talked to Dan P. Lee, who writes predominantly for New York Magazine at the moment, has a collection of really great pieces there, and also is a very candid guy to talk to about his career and about the magazine industry in general.
Yeah, I'm really psyched we got him on. He's been like on the list from the start.
And we got a great sponsor this week. It's Tiny Letter from the good people at MailChimp. We thank them for their sponsorship. I also, I just got a good email here, a podcast listener requesting a guest here, requesting Brian Phillips from Grantland. So we'll try and get Brian Phillips on at some point, and we do appreciate these emails that have come in requesting guests. If you have a guest you'd like to hear on the show, editors at longform.org. Here is Evan and Dan P. Lee.
Hi, Dan.
Hi.
Welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
Did you come up from Philadelphia?
I didn't. I don't live in Philly. I live on a tiny barrier island off the coast of New Jersey, the bottommost part of New Jersey.
Get out.
No, it's near where I grew up. So.
I guess you roosted right for Philadelphia Magazine.
But I ended up in a very probably unwise real estate venture buying this shack on the beach, which... I'm trying to get heat into at the moment, so.
Really?
Yeah. So it's nice and warm in here, which is nice.
Yeah, we set it up just for you. Well, this actually relates to the first thing that I wanted to talk about, which is, you know, we always try to prepare for these interviews, and that's actually one of the most fun parts, is like going back and reading. I've read like 8 of your stories in the last 72 hours.
I apologize.
No, not at all. But we also, you know, like Googling around, seeing... you know, some of your history and things like that. And you maintain one of the lowest online profiles of, I think, anyone that I've ever interviewed for this podcast. Like, it's difficult to even find a photo of you.
Yeah, that's...
online.
Yeah.
Is that intentional?
Yeah, I'm trying to be the print version of Terrence Malick. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah, but it is intentional, yeah.
What's
just a very
it?
Private person, and I'm not... And this probably is... I could... probably have a better career if I'd be a little more public, but it's just not my thing. So I find every day I lose more Twitter followers because my tweets don't apparently connect well. So
it was remarkable that you were even on Twitter after looking around. But
it's just like a personal pet project mostly.
So. Yeah, it feels a little it feels a little non sequitur. It doesn't feel like you're trying to sort of like build up an audience with revelations.
Yeah, I'm not promoting well, but... Every once in a while, I'll retweet a story I've written, but then I feel a little cheap in doing that, but I guess it pays the bills. So.
Well, that's amazing relative to the now wider world of, like, people having, I mean, tweeting, much less, like, a website about all of your work and everything else is, like, standard fare for a writer. Did you reach, like, some point where people were either telling you that you needed to do that or you started to think that and you actually made a conscious decision like, no, actually it's going to be based on my work alone and I don't want myself out there.
I have thought about it a little bit, but I don't live in New York and I'm not, the magazine, sometimes I've done some stories that they've wanted me to do press for, you know, and I've never really wanted to do it because I just feel like I don't really have that much to add. And I'm not that, you know, beyond what I've written in a story, I'm really not that interesting. So that's my thought. So I never really aimed to get into the business anyway. So maybe that's also part of the reason why.
Well, so how did this accidentally happen? I mean, because you're not online, I know nothing.
Yeah.
I know nothing except stories you've written. So
yeah. Well,
as far as I could tell, you like came fully formed as a long form magazine writer at Philadelphia Magazine.
No,
like,
not at all.
7 years ago or something.
Well, the long sordid story is, I guess if... I never wanted to be a journalist at all. I didn't know what I wanted to do, or a writer. And I went to Boston College initially before I ended up transferring to UNC Chapel Hill, which is where I graduated from. But I had a professor there, by the name of Joe Bergantino, who was a...
Boston College?
Yeah, at Boston College, who was, I believe the affiliate is WBZ, the CBS. He was like an investigative reporter for the station up there, and he did this like, you know, lecture. He'd come like in makeup from the studio, and then like... and I took it as a random like elective thing, and I ended up sort of... We did mostly like fake TV news writing, and I sort of took to it a little bit, and he thought I was pretty good, and I really didn't like going to BC. And one day we were like leaving class and walking through like the Gothic campus, and he was like, you know, you should really be a journalist. And I was like, I don't know. And he was like, well, what are you doing here? And I was like, I don't know. And he was like, well, I'll give you a list of journalism schools. And UNC was on there, and I never thought anything of it, and applied, got in, and transferred without ever having visited. Then I got into the J school there, and then I started writing pretty much immediately, like for money, because I've always believed that, you know, you should be paid for writing. So I just started freelancing a little bit. And then my first job, I was, when I graduated from college, I had applied to a bunch of jobs, different papers, and didn't know what I was going to do. I wanted to do the whole Europe thing, and everyone has their like cliche September 11th thing, but I was like, ah, you know, it would be cool to be a newspaper reporter, and I didn't know where else to apply, so I was living with my parents at the time, and I ended up applying to the Atlantic City Press, and I worked there for about 3 years.
Is it daily?
It's a daily newspaper, covering Atlantic City and the southernmost part of New Jersey, and I was a beat reporter there. I spent the entire my entire career there on probation because I did not show up at the appropriate times and they didn't like me. But yeah, that was the beginning of my illustrious career. So I spent a good portion of my career in Philadelphia Magazine on probation as well. So yeah.
So is this you're not a man for deadlines, or
well, my editor could tell you stories about that. No, I just didn't really particularly like working in an office, and yeah, I didn't see why I had to be in the office. And we had there was a very idiosyncratic owner of Philly Mag who wanted everyone to wear suits, and like I like to wear jeans, so that was cause for probation. But anyway, yeah, so that's the beginning, and. Pretty much
not a suit man.
Not a suit man, despite my current appearance. Yeah,
I never heard that a magazine wanting everyone.
Yeah,
to wear
well,
a
my
suit.
Joke
great.
Was always that if you wanted us to wear a suit, you should pay us a lot more money so we could afford one. You know, because we weren't being paid particularly well. But
so, was there? Did you feel like there was a progression from getting to do the work that you wanted to do? That did you idealize a certain type of work or a certain type of writer and say, this is what I want to do and kind of work towards that, or you just fall into different assignments?
Not really. I'm a very long-winded person, so I always found the newspaper constraint to be constraining, so I would always turn in longer drafts and want to do sort of more what they were calling enterprise-type reporting. Mm-hmm. It didn't work out there at all, and so I just sort of left and eventually went to do like a little cliche romp through Europe, and then was like, I think I'm going to write longer stuff. And I ended up applying and getting into an MFA program in North Carolina on the beach at UNC Wilmington. And that was the first of two MFA programs I dropped out of. And there I took a workshop, a nonfiction workshop with John Jeremiah Sullivan, who's, you know,
right,
everyone's
yeah.
favorite.
Yeah.
Whatever. And I had never written anything long or anything at all. And I wrote like a memoir-ish essay for the class. And MFA program, my experience there, which is a long tangent, was very interesting. I'm really sounding misanthropic, but I really didn't get along well with like the way that worked out and was structured
at Wilmington.
Just in general, I don't think that, you know, there's, again, this is like another conversation, but there's a lot of interesting politics and like almost like Dawson's Creek-esque relationships that go on in MFA programs, and I just wasn't good at any of that. And anyway, John was super nice, and the class hated my piece that I had like, you know, poured everything into. and it went really, really badly.
Like you do those, I actually never been in one of these programs,
but
you'd like
it.
People go around the circle and
yeah,
people say.
And yeah. People, you know, and this was very interesting to me because I didn't know anything about, I'd never been workshopped before. I didn't realize it was a verb. And we were just all sitting around and I had written this. It was really long. It was longer than what we were supposed to write. It was a memoir, like I said, which I've never since written anything like that. And the class really didn't like it. And I didn't realize you just go around and each person takes a turn being like, I hate you and I hate this and here's why. And you're not allowed to say anything. So it's like very strange. So I had decided at the end of it that I was going to drop out of the MFA program. This was like the first semester of it. And it was really weird. I mean, I shouldn't even be telling this story, but... And it was funny because I could tell that Sullivan was like letting them go. I mean, after the fact, I could tell. And then, yeah, I've never told this before. It's kind of a strange, it's sort of self-indulgent thing. But yeah. He was like...
That's what we do here.
Exactly, right.
It may not be your thing, but yeah. That's actually what, that's the entire
well,
point
I
of this
figured,
podcast.
Yeah, I want to give you most bang for your buck. So I don't have many boldface names, so I'll throw John in here. But basically, he was really cool. And after, you know, we workshopped two pieces of class, basically, my memory is. And I went second, and I stopped listening to everyone. And I had one of those, like, planners, you know, that you have that the school, you know, with, like, the school holidays and everything. And in there, it had, like, the registrar information, and I was, like, looking up where the office was. I was going to leave directly from there. And
during the class.
Right out. Yeah, I was done. And everyone finished, and I just was really smarting. I felt, like, super bruised, and he was... Everyone was packing up their stuff and leaving. And as I was walking out, he was like, hey, can I talk to you for a minute? And I was like, okay. And then we had this very strange experience. And I didn't know at that point who, you know, I guess John Sullivan wasn't who he was today.
What time period would that be?
I guess this was probably around the mid-2000, about 2005, maybe, 2005, 2006. He had written that piece, which I didn't know who he was until I signed up for the class, and he had done that Unto This Rock piece for GQ, that, like, famous thing.
Yeah.
And then I read that, you know, once I started in the class, I was like, oh, God, this guy's really good. And, we had this very strange walk up to his office where neither one of us spoke a word, and then we went into his office afterward, and he was basically like... those kids are assholes. Don't, I mean, they weren't kids, but you know, people, they're assholes. Don't listen to anything they said. This piece is great and you can be a writer if you want. And I was like, ah, you know, please, no need to placate me. Like I still really had no idea how, you know, successful he was or who he, you know,
really?
Who he was. And I just was being so ridiculous. And I was like, I appreciate you, you know, taking the time to
stop
make me
patronizing
feel
me.
Exactly. And he was like, I don't care anything about you at all. He was like, but you are a good writer, so you shouldn't let that get to you. So this is like the story, I guess. I then became like obsessed with the idea that I couldn't stand writing not for money. I mean, I had been a newspaper reporter. I've always been like, if I'm going to write something, I need to get paid for it.
MFA, you're paying someone else.
Exactly, right. And so the whole thing didn't work well for me. So... I had this idea from when I had worked at the newspaper. There had been this woman who died and her husband was arrested in a small island called Brigantine off the coast of Atlantic City. And he had been arrested. He was a cop. I think he was an Atlantic City cop, but he was a cop and he'd been arrested and charged with killing her. And this story had been ongoing for years when I was at the paper. And as it turned out, the medical examiner of the area, a guy by the name of Elliot Gross, had made an error in the autopsy, which was found by his arch rival, who had preceded him in a very, this was a notorious story in I think the 70s or 80s in New York. They were each the chief medical examiner for New York City. And they had been fighting for years. And I had just been really into the story. I thought it was really cool. And so the second semester I started writing it, you know, and I started like lying to get people to talk to me by being like, oh, you know, I have a publication, a relationship with some publication. I don't know what it is yet, but...
Did you use a real publication or you just make up a...
Well, as it got further on, I started to, yeah. And I think I did even use Philly Mag. I mean, I shouldn't say any of this, but And I had had no relationship with Philly Mag. My grandparents had subscribed to it, and I had read it as a kid at their house. And
it doesn't count as an assignment.
Yeah, like, no, it doesn't. No, it doesn't.
I've worked with them in the past. Yeah. We have a relationship.
Yeah, right. I've read the magazine, so I basically work for them. And anyway, so I started reporting and doing this whole, like, crazy piece and about, you know, and it became a lot about forensic pathology. I got super into it and, you know, traveled around to, like, find out more and finished the piece. And that was, like, the end of my first year. And through a relationship with an old editor I'd had at the paper, at the Atlantic City paper, who had done some freelancing for them, I arranged to have a lunch with an editor, his editor in Philadelphia. And I basically was like, will you read this story? And they said, yeah. And they read it and they bought it and ran it and said, you shouldn't go back to grad school because maybe we'll hire you. So I said, okay. So I actually called John Sullivan on the phone and I said, this magazine's offered me a job. Well, I guess I emailed him and said, can I talk to you on the phone? And he said, yeah, here's my number. Call me. Because we weren't like buddies or anything. And but, you know, I had admired his career, I guess. And he said, you know, you should totally drop out. And you should, like, this is the job that you probably would, if you were lucky, you would get at the end of this experience. So take the job. So I did. I kept waitering. I was waiting tables at a place in Cape May. And I started doing some freelance stuff for Philly Mag because they basically, like, were giving me a test run because I'd never done any long-form writing. I only had newspaper clips. Mm-hmm. And that's how I got a job. That's how it started.
And they hired you on staff as a kind of like full-time
staff. They did. I became a staff writer for them, which was interesting because I didn't know anything about any of this stuff. And this is another stupid tangent, but I was working at this restaurant called Harpoon Henry's in Cape May, which was, you know, featured a guy named Captain Larry who looked like Santa Claus and played Jimmy Buffett songs while people got wasted. And I wasn't a very good waiter, but I went up for this, what I thought was the job interview, and the editor of the magazine and the guy who became my editor took me out to this place called Rouge on Rittenhouse Square, which was at that time like a pretty fancy restaurant. And they were like, get anything you want. And it was like noon and they were like, get a cocktail. And I was like, no. And they were like, no, get a cocktail. So I was like, okay. And then, like, you know, the dance went on and they were like, so, you know, we really like you. We want to offer you a job, like a full-time job on staff. And I said, oh my God, okay, great. And I thought it was totally, you know, untoward to talk about money. So I said nothing. Yeah. I had to be in work at like 4 o'clock back at Harpoon Henry. So I got back down there and I worked with one of the greatest collection of people I've ever worked with. They were mostly all middle-aged women.
Uh-huh.
And, but like really great people. And I was like, they knew I was going and I got back there and they were like, oh, how'd it go? And I was like, it was incredible. They took me to Rouge on Rittenhouse Square. I had not spent much time in Philly. I didn't know anything about it. And I was like, oh, it's like a European garden. And, you know, I had like a cocktail and they offered me a job and they were like, oh my God, did you talk about money? And I was like, no, we didn't talk about money because it would have, you know, it would have been vulgar given how, you know, high class the environment was. I was like, but I'm sure that we're talking at least $85,000 a year. So
yeah.
Then when I got the contract in the mail that was like the thing, I called the editor on the phone and I was like, I don't understand. Is this weekly? Is this because the way the contract was written, it was for, you know, a twice monthly payment. But yeah. I was like, I don't understand how this could add up. What about Rouge? What about the European garden?
You guys are eating at Rouge lunch every day.
Exactly. So
making real money. But you took it anyway. And you had to go tell the captain.
Well, you mean at
the
Harpoon Henry's?
Yeah.
No, because it's sort of, I kept that job because I didn't want to.
Oh, you did?
Oh, yeah. I made more money there than I made, you know, at Philly Mag. So I kept going on there till the end of the season because it closed because it didn't have any walls or anything. You know, it was like an outdoor place. And yeah, and then I worked at Philly Mag for about three years, I'd say. And that was staff versus contract, which I didn't know anything about at the time, the differences between that. So they totally owned me.
Yeah.
And like, I had very little power there at all.
And like you couldn't write for other publications?
Well, I didn't really have the right of refusal for an assignment. There was no number of pieces that I had to fulfill, you know what I mean? There was no protection for me to be like, actually, I'm tired. I don't want to do anything else. It was like, you know, I didn't realize that that was the difference between a staff writer and a, you know, a contract writer where you can negotiate. I don't know, maybe some staff writing jobs are like that, but my experience has been that, you know, you can negotiate with a annual contract the details of, you know, your work, whereas as a staff writer, you're just kind of, I'll say it, you're like someone's bitch, kind of.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
And when this happened to you, did you feel like I'm living the dream now? Like or did it just feel like a job? Like, well, this job is a pretty good job.
I took a very expensive apartment in Philadelphia based on the Rittenhouse Square experience, which I then could not afford once I actually got the contract.
But, wait, really?
Yo, yeah. I mean, I did think that this was a moment of big pimping in my life, but it did not prove to be otherwise. But, you know, my credit card debt proved that. But it was weird. You know, I didn't really realize, you know, I don't mean to sound sort of Pollyannish, but I didn't know anything about the business.
Yeah.
I'd never aspired to be a writer. And I didn't realize at the time, you know, what a great launching pad Philly Mag could be. I mean, there's, you know, they've turned out a rather extraordinary number of very successful long-form writers. So I didn't realize that that was, you know, what I would try to use it for too.
Yeah.
Writing has always been very torturous for me, and it's only gotten worse the longer I've done it. So it's not something that's, I mean, I think there's like two kinds of writers. I often like imagine there's a certain kind of writer, you know, who like sits in front of their computer and almost has like this masturbatory experience as they're like writing. And there's another person who basically, you know, can't bring themselves to sit down to their computer until like, you know, 5:30 in the morning on the day of their deadline. And I'm definitely in the latter camp.
Yeah, myself also being in the latter camp, I think we've found in interviewing lots of writers that the former kind exists, or at least maybe not in the extreme of sort of like the ecstasy of writing, but at least like I sit down and I bang it out, but they're a lot more rare. Like, yeah, those are not 50-50 camps. Those are like 10 and 90 or something.
When I first started, it was like that. The first, and I think that was because of my newspaper experience, which was so immediate. I was used to sitting down in a chair and not getting up until a piece was done. So the original story, the first few stories I wrote for Philly Mag were, you know, I started the piece with the first word and ended it with the last period. And it often went right into print with very little editing. And the first piece I wrote for New York Magazine about Travis the Chimpanzee was also, strangely, that's what got me that job. And that was totally a spec situation.
There was no like Philly Mag piece that someone emailed you from New York Magazine and
no,
said, I read this.
Not really. The Philly Mag, I mean, I don't mean to talk shit on them because it was great and I appreciate the opportunity that I had there, but I left that experience pretty beaten down. And again, like sort of did the cliche like Europe thing where, which I thought would last a lot longer, but, you know, credit cards only, they have limits.
You know, you can keep transferring the balances.
Oh, I've done it, yeah. But eventually, like, you get on some kind of list where it can't happen anymore. But, yeah, and then I didn't know what I was going to do again. It was the same kind of situation. And I actually thought when I left Philly Mag, not to be really sort of cheesy, but I thought that I might not ever write again because it's just, I'm not a prolific writer.
Yeah.
And the experience there, I just felt very misunderstood by the magazine and by the industry, you know, that I extrapolated out of and everything else. So,
like you felt like they wanted something from you that was different than what you could do?
Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed, I guess I'll say this because I've never had the opportunity before. I did pitch a story to Esquire in the middle of my Philly Mag experience, and I got the assignment. And the experience went horribly. It was extremely bad. Those things sort of coincided. The bad experience with Esquire coincided with like my dying days at Philly Mag, and I was just kind of like, fuck this, I'm done. Like, this is not anything that I want to keep doing.
Hey everyone, this is Evan. I wanted to pause the interview with Dan for a moment for a word from our sponsor. And this week our sponsor is actually The Atavist. Often we have an outside sponsor for the podcast, but we had a couple of great new stories recently, so we thought we would sponsor it ourselves. So if you go to atavist.com, you'll find our latest, which is a piece by Jennifer Sky. It's called Queen of the Tokyo Ballroom. It's a memoir of her time as a teen model in Tokyo. It's great. It's a wonderful piece of writing, and you can buy it right there. You can buy it in our app and read it right away. While you're there, you can also check out any of our past pieces, including the last one. John Mualim, who you've heard on this podcast, has a piece called American Hippopotamus, which is a really brilliant look at a effort to introduce hippopotamuses to the United States. You can also become a member and get everything we've got, including the whole back catalog. So check it out, atavist.com. And here we are back to Dan P. Lee.
So I, you know, didn't know what I was going to do, and I just stopped, you know, and I started sort of waiting tables and, you know, planning the European dream again.
I am curious what the dimensions of the like Esquire debacle were, if they were just like the story got killed, or I mean, I also don't want you to like shit on anyone for whatever,
you know, I don't know if it's useful for me to get into this, but I'll tell you and sort of trust you, which is like the last thing, you know, as a reporter you ever do. But I think
that's why I dressed up.
Yeah, exactly. You're tricking me. Yeah,
man, you can trust your secrets.
Yeah, exactly.
Safe in this.
I mean, this microphone obviously isn't recording anything.
Don't worry about it.
Yeah, these headphones are to keep us warm. But yeah, the experience there was just that I had had an idea for which I'm since resurrected, and I'm working on now for someone else. But for a very kind of out there story. And the experience I had with the editor there was just really, really bad. And I felt, frankly, that there was a kind of dumbing down that needed to happen with the subject. And there was kind of a muscularizing up of the prose simultaneously that was going on there that just felt incredibly, incredibly unnatural to me. It was not my voice, and that was not my story. And, you know, when you're in your, I mean, I guess then I was probably in my mid-20s or so. And Esquire is in front of you as a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe this is instructive to repeat this to people who, I mean, because I don't know, you know, but that's intoxicating. And the idea that that could fall apart is so devastating.
Yeah.
You know, you think.
I think I'm right on the edge of
something. I'm right on the edge.
Huge,
I mean, it doesn't get any bigger than Esquire. And you, you know, I had fetishized these magazines. And then, you know, that experience ended up being great because that isn't who I am. You know, I don't write like that. There's, you know, and again, I don't want to marginalize those magazines and say that they only do one thing. But certainly as a relatively no-name writer from Philadelphia Magazine, my kind of experimental ideas were not, you know, did not go over well.
Yeah, you're going to get, I mean, there's a house voice. You're going to get pulled into the house voice. Yeah. And
some people do that incredibly well, and I envy them for that. But that's been one of the more helpful realizations that I've had, is that that is not me. I don't do that. I don't do it well. And I frankly don't really connect to it all that well either. So it's easier to just be like, there's lots of magazines out there, fewer every day, but there are magazines out there, and there's a home for everyone, I guess.
And then, so how did, you said you did the Travis the Chimp story on Spec. I mean, that's a story, I didn't realize, I guess I didn't look at all the dates, I didn't realize that was your first story for New York Magazine, mm-hmm. but that was one where, you know, writers like probably look at bylines 1,000 times more than the average person ever looks at a byline.
Yeah.
But that story, I swear, I was reading that story, and that was one where I flipped back to the beginning, I was like, who the fuck wrote this? Who is this person? Because that story is amazing.
Yeah.
But you did that. How did you
decide
to do it?
I mean, this is, again, hopefully a lot of this in the weed stuff will get edited out later. But I had gone and traveled around and fucked around and done some stupid stuff. And then I had actually moved back in with my parents briefly because I didn't have any money. And my grandmother, to whom I'd been very close, had fallen ill. And she'd had a stroke, and we were sort of helping to take care of her and like kind of trying to rehabilitate her. She was a great character and real, I mean, if I had to be sort of, this is drawing too many parallels, but she was really into telling stories. Mm-hmm. That was kind of, I think, I've always been into telling stories. Mm-hmm. So I was helping to take care of her, and I was, I re-enrolled in an MFA program and was simultaneously teaching at Rutgers in Camden and outside of Philly. And I was taking care of her one day, and she had a daily ritual of the shows that she watched. And she watched General Hospital, which was followed by at 4 o'clock by Oprah Winfrey,
mm-hmm.
which, you know, I have very conflicted feelings about Oprah, like I think most people do. But
I'm not sure I would agree with most people. A lot of people.
A lot of people.
But there are a lot of people yeah. in the world that do not have conflicted feelings about Oprah. But anyway, continue.
I try to surround myself with those people who have conflicted feelings about Oprah. But... So, yeah, and she did a show about, I don't know that the whole show was about Travis the Chimp, but some of it was.
Mm-hmm.
And she had Sharla Nash, who was the mauling victim, on the show in what was her first television interview.
Like revealing the face
showed
transplant.
Showed her, this was pre-face transplant.
Oh, okay.
So she had showed her face and sort of... And I just, you know, I normally would be, excuse me, doing a whole bunch of other stuff while she'd be watching TV. And I just remembered watching it. And I was just like, holy shit, I've never seen anything like this. And I know in the piece I actually wrote, like, that, you know, describing that, that was one of the most extraordinary moments in television history.
Yeah.
I still think it is.
Yeah.
And so I was like, wow, this is a crazy story. And I've had this thing. Always from back being a newspaper reporter where I'll feel really envious about reporters who are on a story that I really like.
Yeah.
And so I had – it been – I think everybody who was interested in stories was compelled by that Travis the Chimp story when it came out.
For sure.
So I'd done my best to ignore everything about it because I just had this very sort of immature reaction to stories that I don't want to know anything about a story that I – would want to be a part of.
Even if at the time you're not even actually doing it. You're just
exactly.
thinking like, I'm interested in the story.
Yep.
I don't want to see other people.
I don't want to know anything about it. Exactly uh-huh. right. So I had read nothing about it basically, you know, and I had seen her and then I just was so taken by this and I thought like, I want to write a story about this. And so I, like I said, I was teaching at Rutgers in Camden and taking some classes there too. And, I ended up writing a pitch, a short one-page pitch, not even knowing like sort of what I was doing or why. And Jessica Pressler, who I work with at New York Magazine and who I worked with at Philadelphia Magazine and with whom I'm pretty good friends or good friends, she had been at New York Magazine at that time. I think she was pretty much on the website.
Mm-hmm.
And... You know, she was so generous to me, and I have to say, you know, that's been an interesting part of this experience is to see, like, the generosity of other writers toward other writers because yeah. it can go both ways.
Yeah, for sure.
Completely. And she was like, you know, here's some names of some people at the magazine. You should send the pitch to them. And this had this moment had sort of corresponded with David Haskell, who was the features editor there. And I think now his official title is the deputy editor.
He's also a liquor baron.
Exactly. He's a man of many hats. But he had sort of just started, I think, segueing into editing features. And he was looking for writers from what I can sort of put together. And I had sent him that pitch. The pitch made its way to him. And he wrote me back the same day and was like, we're super enthused by this pitch. Would you want to do it? And I said, okay. And then, you know, we had had this real debate about was, you know, I had pitched this as a profile of Sharla Nash, basically. What is it like to live today like this now?
Yeah. And how do you pitch something like that? Because that, I mean, it's almost like people would think that it was off limits. I mean, it was on the fucking Oprah Winfrey show.
Yeah.
You would say
yeah.
like, how could anyone possibly go in and write yeah, about this?
Exactly.
Now?
And I would never do it again. You know, now knowing what I know today, I would be like, that's a ridiculous idea. There's nothing there. Well, I don't know if I'd feel that way because I've had this experience a lot of times with pieces I've written that you think the earth is scorched, but it's really not.
Mm-hmm.
And so anyway, yeah, we had had this conversation about the focus of the piece, and Adam Moss had been interested in the story for a long time. And, you know, it was a way-in issue. And pretty quickly it became the case that Charlotte was not going to be the focus of the piece. They were a little reluctant at that from the beginning, and then Charlotte's people immediately squashed it for me and mm-hmm. basically wouldn't cooperate because they had had a financial relationship with NBC News and sort of the things that go on with that.
Right.
So
for her story, you know, exactly, the victim story. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yeah. So, you know, I was just like, shit, I don't know what I'm going to do here, you know. And I realized at that point, I had an idea that this was a big deal, that if I could get this story and execute it well, I could get more work out of New York Magazine and I could get into, you know, a good, you know, realm of magazine writing. So, yeah, I then started on this hunt to try to find out, you know, what else there was that hadn't been reported and sort of what I would do. And I'm the kind of reporter who prefers quality over quantity. So I'm always kind of looking for the best source, not mm-hmm. the most sources. And
I think we should probably stop. First of all, people should read it if they haven't read it. But also we should point out that the main rest of the main people in this story were deceased.
Everyone was dead in the story. Everyone was dead, which was good and bad. And I basically started trolling chat sites, internet chat sites. And I've said this one other time I've talked about the story. In a like search and sequence of events I couldn't replicate for all the money in the world, like in a spinning black hole of the internet, I found this person and sort of put this, you know, note out there if this person who seemed to know something, if they would get in touch with me. And they did. And we had this weird dance. They wouldn't reveal who they were or their relationship to Sandy Harold, who became the protagonist of the piece uh-huh. alongside Travis, her son/chimp. And I went up to Connecticut and met this person in a Jamba Juice, not knowing who they were or if they would show. And they had, you know, they'd stood me up a couple times ahead of this. And we met in this Jamba Juice and sort of just had a conversation that went on for like more than an hour that was not about Travis, and that in which I still did not learn the identity of this person. And then at one point in the conversation, the person revealed their identity, and they were in fact I just don't want to sort of reveal because they yeah. didn't want it, but they were basically a family member.
And they were not in the story. They didn't end up in the story.
They did not. And they had really never been in anything before. And, you know, what almost every story I've written goes the same way. We commenced a relationship, you know, a long-term relationship. This is very standard for me in stories. I probably interviewed this person for, I don't know, maybe 30 hours total, split out over periods of time.
So this was your one, this was your source that had
too,
everything.
Exactly.
But this was
a great, great source. And, you know, and I trespassed on the property. You know, the everything had been frozen in time because Sandy had died not long after Travis had.
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of, and there was the ongoing lawsuit from Charlo, which froze everything. And literally the house was just frozen as it was the day that she died. So, you know, I trespassed and I sort of really went as far as I could to get as much as I could. And the story, I hate to say this because it sounds ridiculous, but it almost did write itself. And quickly it appeared to me as a fairy tale.
That's,
you know,
and I have it written down right here.
Yeah.
Starts like a fairy tale. It really does. Yeah. The story of how she came to love mm-hmm. chimps and everything else, it's like, and then it's like a fairy tale that yeah. just slowly turns.
And the experience with New York was incredible. David was awesome. I mean, I sent in the first, that piece was very minimally edited, less than any other piece I think I've ever written, which I think was one of the reasons why they were so excited to hire me. Little did they know the next draft and everyone after I'd submit it 30,000 words, you know, and we would start our, you know, whatever. But they were great. Great. I mean, the experience of working for them immediately was really interesting. First of all, working with people in New York was interesting. I had had, like I said, the very bad experience with Esquire. Notwithstanding, people in, you know, the bigger people in New York were always incredibly kind to me and much more willing to understand that, you know, every writer is a little different and needs different treatment. And I thought the first draft I sent was terrible. I'd been up for days writing it. And David sent me this email, I'll never forget, back that said, like, you know, this is the kind of draft editors dream about getting, and get some sleep and we'll talk later. And yeah, and that was it. And they offered me a job based on that. It was the same experience I had had with Philly Mag. And just one interesting aside about that piece is that in terms of editing, you know, Adam Moss has this very legendary persona in, you know, the business. And I don't know him particularly well at all, but the first section had been very much the way that it was, but I had used, you know, that I'd always had this conflicted relationship with Nut Graphs, you know, as a newspaper reporter. We all do.
We all.
Yeah. And I had had this, you know, sort of graph at the end of it that that was like, you know, Jessica Pressler and I used to joke when we worked at Philly Mag that every story needed that bump bump that's in the Law and Order. You know, in Law and Order, whenever like there's that bump bump sound that like is signifies something.
Yeah.
So we used to make jokes about it all the time, like, where's the bump bump in this piece and you need one. And so that had that there, and it was the first section ended with that. And I'll never forget it. You know, David and I had gone back and forth that it needed something to suggest that something was going to happen later. And Adam had had, you know, relatively few edits, but when the draft came back, he slashed that and he was like, we don't need that. Just let it go. And I thought that was such a great thing, because it meant like, oh, cool, you're interested. The other thing about that story that was so unusual is it has no attribution in the entire thing.
Yeah, it's actually just a straight...
It's straight. There's no quotes.
Yeah.
I mean, there are some like live quotes inside. And people have asked me about that. There's a section in it when I'm quoting a scene inside their house.
Mm-hmm.
That was an incredible moment where I had obtained a home video. And I was, so that was not made up. That story was in 100%, you know, factual. And they were cool. The magazine was confident with, you know, the source backup that I gave them and everything, that we didn't have to sort of clunk up the narrative by saying such and such said or according to. And I remember when the lawyer was vetting that piece, I heard that the lawyer like had all these red marks and was like, shit, you know, this is terrible. And then got to the end and was like, oh my God, everyone's dead. Like,
yeah.
We're fine. Like, let's go.
He's liable to shit out of these people.
Yeah, exactly.
But they're all dead.
They're all dead. So, yeah.
But I want to duck back into talking for a second about that editor-writer relationship, because you said it felt different there, and other than, you know, Adam Moss and the idea of sort of like letting the narrative be itself, what were the other aspects of, why did it feel different? Like, what is it about your approach that you felt like is accommodated by working with them that you hadn't felt that way before?
Well, I feel weird about doing it, but I'm going to. The editor at Philadelphia Magazine, who I had at the time, had been mercurial and difficult to deal with. And, you know, I give them their due that they were, you know, I appreciate what they did for me and for my career, but they did not understand me and they were not interested in trying to understand me. And, you know, at one of the points when I was being put on probation, which was never for my work, it was always for arbitrary things.
Is that a real thing? Like, literally?
Oh, yeah. There's like a note, yeah. And I guess it goes in your file. And
oh, I thought it was just speech.
No, I would all, and a friend of mine who was also on probation at the Atlantic City Press would always say that we were being actively probated, you know, at the time. So he had taken me into his office at one point, and I was always on the verge of being fired for something. And, you know, the truth is I do blow deadlines. I mean, David Haskell will attest to this to the end. But, you know, I always was very serious about my work and wanted to do the best that I could do. And he took me in his office and was basically like, you know, it's not clear to me whether you're going to have a career or not. You might, but you probably will fuck it up. And that was kind of like the mentality that they had sort of had toward me.
Like, so, sort of tough love,
yeah,
kind
of thing? Yeah, it was fair. Yeah, and there was overtones of like sort of like a paternalistic attitude that was weird, that I was like young and I was like some kind of like, you know, like Barnacle from the Styx and Sea of Cape May County, New Jersey, which has its own sort of like thing, you know, that I was from down the shore, quote unquote, which has always been something that galls me. I hate that expression. Nobody who lives there calls it, you know, down the shore, or the Jersey Shore. But So it was always that kind of thing. And then, so I had like internalized a lot of that. And then when I started working with David and with New York Magazine, they were, they took me seriously, and they were, they just understood that the process was complicated for me, and they were willing to give me the room that I needed. And, you know, even just in talking about stories and the way that I wanted to approach them. I mean, the Anna Nicole Smith piece that I wrote, the first draft of that was in a screenplay form. And I wanted to do that as a nonfiction screenplay. I thought that that was the greatest idea in the world. Maybe it still is. And, you know, they didn't react to that by being like, "You're on probation, you freak."
It goes in your file.
Exactly right. They were like, "Well, this isn't probably going to work, but we like the cinematic aspects, and here's how maybe we can make this work." So there's always, there's been just, you know, we've just had a more agreeable relationship, I would guess, I would say.
Yeah.
And I hate the fact that I'm talking shit about Philly Mag, because I'm not trying to, but, you know, I mean, everybody has a different experience, you know, and, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think part of why we like talking to writers, like I love talking to writers, because it's just the ways in which you kind of approach it and the ways in which editors respond to you. I mean, I'm sure we could get, we've had other Philly Magazine alums in here who probably say, even that same editor would say, when he sat me down and said, "You're a good writer, but don't fuck it up," they were like, "All right." And then, you know, it's just...
Exactly right. And my reaction to that was like, "Well, fuck you. I'm out of here. You know, as soon as I can find a waitering job, I'm gone." You know, so that, I mean, I'm your point's well taken. And I'm probably not the easiest person to deal with in many ways. But at the risk of sounding, you know, overly cute and precious, like, I do believe in the art of writing, you know, and that's the most important thing to me.
Well, then now, I mean, now that you're at New York, I mean, you have a wide range of pieces that you've been doing the last few years. I mean, they're sort of hard to categorize. I was trying to, you know, find some through lines and sort of see what like categories I felt they fell into. But there are some that are like celebrity profile is not quite the right word, but they touch on celebrity or they touch on pop culture in some way. And there are some that are just very far on the other end of the spectrum where they. I was thinking of them as like stories that ask you to like face up to something very serious and potentially very horrible. And so I guess first I'm curious, like, how does that range of stories come about? Is it, do you just follow your own interests, or is some of it coming your way from David Haskell or other editors? How does that?
It's a little of both. I have a really, you know, enviable situation there where I have the right of refusal, so they can't make me do anything I don't want to do. Sometimes I'm in a position there where I feel that my stock is low and I'll do something I really probably wouldn't otherwise do to try to endear myself to them. But, you know, I have a particular worldview. Everyone does. It sounds ridiculous to say and sort of, I don't know, I don't want to be intellectually superficial. But, you know, there are a lot of sort of philosophical ideas that I'm interested in, and, you know, from the time that I was in high school, existentialism has been kind of something that I've been interested in. And I think that you can, if you're looking for a through line in my stories, those narrative pieces tend to, I think, have a lot about that, about, you know, sort of how I see the world.
But they tend to not, I'm thinking specifically of the Stamford, Connecticut fire story. Like, it's not really about providing answers. Like,
exactly.
You might start that story thinking, "I'm going to find out how this man is redeemed."
Yeah,
but that wasn't my experience of reading. It's very difficult to read.
Yeah, it is, and it was very difficult to report and to write. And I think that's actually the story I'm proudest of. I don't like anything I've ever written. I try not to ever read it again. Yeah, I don't believe in answers, you know, so that's what compels me to write all of these stories. I mean, none of them ends nicely, you know, none of them end neatly. And that's been difficult. And that's why when you talk about celebrity profiles, if you're talking about recently, I profiled Alfonso Cuarón and Steve McQueen.
Yeah, and Fiona Apple.
Well, that was its own
different kind of thing.
Yeah. But
those
we'll
talk about that.
Those two in particular, were reactions to that. I'm really interested in film in a very armchair, way. I don't know anything about it, but and that's kind of been a way to sort of move away from. There's only so many. I'm working on another one right now that kind of fits into this, you know, my sort of collection of existential magazine stories. But I've always hated stories that end with a bow at the end, because I don't think life ends with a bow at the end, you know? And so for me, that's really been something that's been, you know, and I think of that. Like I said, I'm very proud of that Stamford Fire story. It's the only one I think I'm very proud of, but I think that that story was incredibly carefully constructed and calculated, but I don't think that it necessarily reads that way or in a way that the thing that I think that I can do the best as a writer in this kind of genre is I can accurately portray the experience that I had reporting it without making it about myself. But that story, the fire story, felt the way I felt immersed in his world and in the world of that tragedy. And I think that that's the best that I can do, is to be sort of truthful and honest to the feeling, you know?
But it also seems like you'll delve into details. Like, that story has a very detailed account of what happened that would be hard for anyone, I think, to read. Mm-hmm. And obviously you had to, like, report those details. But other stories have that too. Like, the chimp story has, like, the 911 call. Like, you don't sort of pull back from the like, most horrible details. Mm-hmm. Even the GQ story has really details of the guy's car accident that he gets into. And I feel like, is that something that you sort of just happens natural in your writing? I want to, like, get as far as possible into this? Or are you actually saying, in a philosophical sense, like, we should face up to these details? Like, if you're going to read about this, you should read exactly what happened. Here's what happened.
Absolutely. And, you know, I've had a weird experience where, especially with, it's funny with John Sullivan, who I should add, you know, he and I have, since I left UNCW, we have not, I think we may have had one interaction over all these years. So it's not like I have any, you know, I'm not selling his books or whatever, but, you know, I had, in the beginning, I was very taken with his style of writing. I do think he's one of the best writers in any kind of writing that we've got out there today. And he's incredibly intelligent, and you can feel that in his writing. His intelligence comes through really strongly. But so in the beginning, when I first started writing, I really wanted to be that kind of writer. You know, he's clever, he's funny, he does all these things really, really well. And I thought, I want to do that. And I tried to do it, and it didn't work. And then I think this is what it's about a little bit, if I have any advice to impart. But it's sort of about finding your voice and finding out what you do, and then sort of pushing that as far as you can. So it's funny, the Travis story. When I wrote that one of the things I hated about it is I felt like it was very underwritten. You know, the actual writing of it.
Very straightforward.
It's very straightforward. And that was the thing that David and Adam and these people really connected with the most. And, you know, Adam even sent me a couple really nice emails where he was basically talking about my style and how much he loves my style. And I was like, I don't understand what you're talking about. There is no style here. I almost felt that those pieces were without style. But then I realized that, like, when you're writing these kinds of stories, especially, the writing often can get in the way. And sometimes it's harder to let the details work, you know, and let the writing step back. So I don't know if that answers your question, but, I do feel really, you know, yeah, absolutely. If you're going to read a story about, a tragedy, then, you know, you should feel it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I guess, I mean, there's an alternative approach to it that would be, you know, you get to that point and it's sort of like, we all know what happened next,
yeah,
you know, which was true, I think, in a lot of these stories, like, you could elide
Yeah, absolutely.
Those details.
You're right. And I think I've thought about that a lot. And again, I'm working on a story right now that's got a little bit of this in it, but it's very different in some ways. But I'm a very cinematic thinker. And I'm not trying to say I'm special in that way. I think a lot of writers are and a lot of people are. I think that's the genre of our time is cinema. You know, it's not the written word. So what almost always compels me to a story is a single scene. And in these stories, you know, that we're talking about here, there is that scene. And I feel like if I can deliver enough context around it that I can then give you that scene, like, as far as I can take it, you know, as intense as I can do it, then, you know, that's what I try to do.
And let's talk about this Fiona Apple story a little bit.
Oh, God, do we have to?
Yeah. Have you had to talk about it a lot? I feel like
I don't talk about anything.
Yeah, I know.
It's very...
It certainly was different.
It was different.
And it was... I mean, I guess the first thing I'm curious about... So, just to, like, in the course of the story, you basically become friends with Fiona Apple in some form or another.
Mm-hmm.
How transactional that is sort of, like, part of the story in some ways.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had other people on, like Amy Wallace and people who do celebrity profiles in all sorts of different ways.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess I'm curious first if you got the sort of, like, you know, journalism pushback that was like, well, this is not really how you're supposed to do it, or mm-hmm. this is over the top, or this is indulgent, or any of those kind of responses.
Well, I try really hard to stay away from what anyone's saying about anything, because I'm a very self-conscious person. It doesn't do me much good.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really even know that. I mean, obviously every once in a while, like in a dark moment, I'll Google and try to find, and I'm looking specifically for the most vituperative, most horrible thing that a person has said, you know, or if I'm scanning the comments of a story I've written, which I never do at all anymore.
Yeah.
I'm only looking for the one where the person's like, this guy's horrible. But I think from what I understand, there was that did exist. There was another writer who was asked about this. This will be a convoluted way to explain this, but I just am not interested in getting into a pissing match with anybody. But there was another writer who was asked about this story in an odd way. And that writer responded that there's a long tradition of men trying to seduce the female subjects that they're writing, which I got quite a laugh out of for a whole host of reasons. But that was not what happened here at all. It ran the gamut, I think, of reactions about, you know, there were people who criticized the fact that I was in the piece all, or that, you know, I included details about myself. And I guess what I would try to say, and this is self-aggrandizing, but, like, I think that that piece enabled you to get to know Fiona Apple better than any sort of traditional kind of, you know, journalistic, you know, construction that you could imagine. And I couldn't care less about journalism in that instance. Like, I'm not, like, reporting on Al-Qaeda, you know what I mean? Like, this is a profile of Fiona Apple, and, like, I mean, I actually don't call myself a journalist, and I don't see what I'm doing as journalism. So it's very, again, a little self-indulgent, but...
You think of it more as just nonfiction writing or narrative writing?
I think of it, this is like enough, the gong should go now, but I think of it as art. And I think that, you know, I think that I try to make art. I probably fail most of the time at it, but so that's all I care about. I couldn't, and, you know, in the future, looking forward to what I want to do, I'm interested in making it weirder and as unconventional as I possibly can and still exist in, you know, a money-making enterprise. But so I don't care at all about that. And yeah, that story was very weird. You know, the experience was extremely weird. Again, the only in my defense, I would say that, and Fiona said this after the fact too, that she felt that it was incredibly realistic to our experience. And that to me was the highest praise I could get. And that's the, you know, the best I can do.
And the other thing that I thought was interesting is you are very much in that piece. I mean, you're in meeting with her, you're getting stoned, you're doing these different things, you're at her house, you're talking to your brother and all these. But I still didn't know that much about you. Like, there's this moment in the story where you say, then I told her something incredibly intimate about myself. Yeah. And then you don't say what it is.
Yeah. Well, that's the inside baseball part we can talk about, which is I did in the first draft.
Oh, really?
I won't tell you, but I did. I did. It was in there. And apparently, you know, I'm away from Varick Street and New York Magazine headquarters, so I don't know that much of what goes on there, which is probably better.
Just out on an island.
Exactly. Yeah, it sounds a lot more freezing and having pipes exploding, but, you know. But apparently that was a point of debate in the office about what should be done with that. And that went on until the 11th hour. And ultimately, the resolution was the one that we all agreed with, the way that should be handled. But when I look back on it, I'm really glad that it was left out. It didn't seem, it would have really been a distraction. It wasn't about me. Ultimately, you know, it's not a personal essay. It is basically a profile. So,
in a manner of speaking. Yeah. It's about primarily one person for sure.
Exactly.
So you're living on an island of some sort, mm-hmm. without heat or do you have to take a boat out there?
Nope. It's a part of the network of the barrier islands that sort of, you know, string down along the East Coast. Oh, so okay. It's right off the coast. You just take a bridge and through the marsh to get there.
And I mean, obviously that's a different approach. And we've talked about sort of being outside of the like greater magazine publishing industry. But do you feel like you know what you want out of this at this point? That like you're kind of, just I'll go along with doing New York Magazine stuff, or you have like a greater thought of like, okay, now I see where this goes from here.
Yeah, I mean, I feel that we should, you know, if we're winding down here, we should end it with the ultimate cliche, which is that I do kind of want to write movies. So like that is kind of what I would like to do eventually and sooner than later. And in a weird way, I think that this work has helped prepare me to do it. So that's kind of, I mean, I still enjoy writing magazine stories. As I said before, it's become increasingly difficult for me. Everyone, they just, and I'm, you know.
Just to stop for a second right there, do you feel like, do you know why it is? Do you feel like you're repeating yourself or it's, why is it, it seems like it could get easier over time.
I don't entirely know why. I don't know if it's, you know, it's weird. Every single time I sit down to write a story, I'm convinced I can't do it this time. Every time. And people around me will be like, oh, that's stupid. Why do you think that? But I can't tell you why. I just do. And, you know, there's no more horrible sight than an empty Microsoft Word document, like, blinking in front of you. It's like, and there's so many things that I want to say, I guess. There's so many things I have in my head that I want to try to communicate. And I know that the process between here and there is just sort of torturous. So I don't know if, you know, maybe I have a better sensibility now than I did before.
Mm-hmm.
But it's just, it's become really difficult for me to execute it. And again, I'm not a prolific person. I do over report. I will pursue a tangent to the bottom of the ocean and, you know, we'll spend 6 weeks writing that sentence into the piece to have it eventually cut. You know, like, I still haven't totally learned how to stop doing that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I'm doing a story now that involves weather. So, you know, and when I wrote that, the fire story, I got manuals from, you know, National Fire Codes, and I tried to learn as much as I could in my sort of, you know, imbecile mind about how fire works and everything else. And a lot of time, you know, I read books and books about chimpanzees, you know, and this is the way. And I think a lot of people, when I wrote the GQ story, I read the bulk of a reproductive textbook. I mean, I have textbooks all over my house. The space story was like,
oh yeah, that we've even talked about that. But yeah,
like, yeah. I mean, that was, you know, so many books. So I mean, I reported that for months. I went.
That was on your. I noticed that from your Twitter feed. That
all over.
Way back, you were saying you started quote. You had a few things about, you know, space flight and.
Yeah, I love space. I'm really into space, and that's kind of the little bit of the conflicted thing I have is that, like, I would like to write. I have talked about writing a book about space. It's been something I've batted around for a while with, like, an agent and stuff like that. But I don't think I can commit to I don't think I can commit like that. It's a big commitment. Yeah.
And do you see yourself just jumping off into movies or saying, I'm going to write a screenplay?
We all need money. Yeah. You know, that's the thing about it is that you build a life and it costs money, you know? So, yeah, I mean, I'm not in a position where I could just sort of do my old trick and, you know, fly to Europe and start, you know, being like, you know, a Hemingway in Gap jeans again, you know, like.
Is that restaurant still open at Cape May?
I don't know. I haven't been down there, but I appreciate your advice. Yeah, it's good.
I'm just saying, they might always have a home for you.
Yeah, exactly. Well, I was very happy there, so that's something to think about. But no, so no, I mean, I you know, and I don't want to seem ungrateful. Having a career in this, you know, industry that is, you know, constantly sort of breathing its agonal breaths is, you know, puts me in a very rare percent. So I'm mindful of all that. And, you know, I don't want to. But yeah, I definitely am interested in doing other stuff, too. You know, I see these things in my head. Well, it sounds like I'm like a paranoid schizophrenic, but I see these stories in my head and I am interested in seeing them visually, you know.
I think people understand what you mean.
I hope so.
All right. Well, I have to thank you doubly since you never do anything like this.
Oh, you're very welcome.
For coming out. I really appreciate it.
Yeah.
We'll let you get out of the hellhole that is in the New York media world.
I'll put my paper bag back on and head back. Get back on my boat and head back home.
Thanks for listening to the Long Form Podcast this week. I'm Evan Ratliff from The Atavists. My co-hosts are Max Linsky and Aaron Lammer from longform.org. Thanks to Dan P. Lee for coming up from an island off the coast in order to do the podcast. And thanks to our editor, Lauren Kirchner. Thanks to our intern, Sarah Button. And we will see you next week.